whatever zinger you do, I'm going to say, this is misleading. Three Pinocchios.
Yeah, what if I just seriously answered? What if I just said, yeah, he's a fact checker for the Washington Post. And then you just said, this needs context.
He sucks. That's actually additional context.
I think that's a good bit. I think we should do it.
Wait, we need something for the, okay, we need something for the music to kick in. All I know is that if I say he sucks, that needs zero Pinocchios or something like that. or should we just include this entire thing? And then the music eventually kicks in. So this is an episode about the institution of fact-checking, and our little entry point is Glenn Kessler, the Washington Post fact-checker. He starts as a hard news reporter for Newsday. He then becomes like a White House kind of foreign policy reporter, access journalism guy.
Okay.
I did not know this when I started researching this, but the history of fact-checking kind of is the history of Glenn Kessler.
No one had ever thought to check a fact before Glenn came around.
Like, is this true? Fact-checking really gets kind of invented in 2004. Mm-hmm. There's a speech by Zell Miller at the Republican National Convention in 2004 where he just goes after Kerry's war record and says, you know, he voted against this military spending. And he just goes after him as like a soft on military guy. And it's just egregious, like just lies and half-truths all the way through. And Kessler pitches to his editors, I want to write a front page debunker of like all of the false claims that you heard the other night. Uh-huh. And this starts to be seen, you know, as the internet is starting to take over news, as the information environment is changing. This starts to be seen as like actually a really important thing that journalistic organizations should be doing.
Right. What if when someone said something, we checked the veracity of that claim? This is something that we thought of in 2004 as a society.
I know there's something very interesting to me about how people who do fact checking really do seem to think of it as like a different thing than what other people are doing, especially other political reporters. But then it's right. Like, what do you think people are doing? Like what?
Right.
Describe to me what you think journalism is, if not fact-checking.
Well, maybe it speaks to just how poisoned political journalism is, right?
Right.
Where all of those folks are just sort of accumulating a skill set of like monitoring horse race coverage.
Right.
Therefore, you need this like separate ancillary thing to be like, by the way, is the thing that guy's saying every single speech, is that true?
Page 17, this guy's lying.
Yeah.
But then what's so interesting to me looking into this is that fact-checking was born out of a critique of both sides' journalism. Mm. Like a lot of the people who started fact-checking within these newsrooms were crusaders and reformers against exactly the critiques of media that me and you make on this show all the time.
Oh.
So this is an excerpt from a really interesting book called Deciding What's True, The Rise of Political Fact-Checking in American Journalism by Lucas Graves.
The speech by Zell Miller was a kind of epiphany for me, where I did nothing but write a horse race story and really felt guilty about it. Bill Adair, founder of PolitiFact, told fellow fact-checkers at a 2011 meeting. This grew out of my own guilt. I had covered political campaigns and felt that I had been a passive co-conspirator in sort of passing along inaccurate information and hadn't fact-checked it the way I should. And so I went to my editors with a proposal that we create a website where we would do fact-checking full-time.
So between 2004 and 2007 is where we start to get the foundation of things like PolitiFact. The New York Times has its own fact-checking desk. This becomes like a department within newsrooms of like, we have specialists that are going to look into all of the factual claims that you're hearing. Mm-hmm. Washington Post launches the fact-checker column in 2007. Glenn Kessler takes it over in 2011. And Glenn Kessler himself says that the Pinocchio ratings, which is not something that he invented. That was the previous guy that did the fact checker column. But he sort of relaunched the fact checker column. And he decided to keep the Pinocchio ratings specifically as a response to both sides of journalism, right? That we need to have standard metrics.
That's his idea of a standard metric.
This thing that's not arbitrary at all. It's an objective metric of whether or not somebody's lying. This is from the introduction to his 2020 book, Donald Trump and His Attacks on Truth.
It is like a reverse restaurant review, ranging from one Pinocchio, selective telling of the truth, to four Pinocchios, a whopper. Those Pinocchios got politicians' attention. No longer could they expect the newspaper to settle for dueling quotes from both sides, leaving readers puzzling over who was right. Instead, we are the reader's advocate, showing them how we do our research and why a politician's claim is misleading.
So we're not doing both side stuff. You can actually look at this as like an index, and they pretty soon they start producing kind of like home pages with politicians where you can look through, you can like look up, you know, Bill Clinton or like Bernie Sanders and be like, okay, what's his overall Pinocchio rating?
How many Pinocchios has he accumulated over time?
Over time, right? And then you can have like almost like an index of like, okay, here's Hillary Clinton. She has like 3.17 Pinocchios, and here's Donald Trump. He has like 3.8 Pinocchios. And you can actually start to look at like different averages. I think this is fucking asinine, but I'm going to pretend that I don't, because we're going to have, you know, like developments and twists later.
This is very admirable to think that you could sort of like do, you know, or to want to do this.
I know.
But the as soon as you're like, we will turn this into an objective science, here's my scale of 1 to 4 Pinocchios. 4 Pinocchios, of course, reflecting a whopper, another abstraction.
Another complete abstraction, I
like,
know.
What are you talking about, dude?
It's also this thing that Glenn, from the very beginning, doesn't seem to understand how kind of selective his own process is, right? Because he says they also have something called a Geppetto for when you make just a factually true statement. He's like, we almost never give out the Geppettos. It's rare that a politician earns a Geppetto.
And then you have a Jiminy Cricket for someone who says something that's sort of spiritually insightful.
Right.
This, of course, is a donkey boy.
But then I think, I mean, this sort of starts to point to some of the problems with this entire endeavor, that if you're only rarely giving out a that was true rating, you're obviously choosing the lies.
Yeah.
Like, you're choosing to look into things that are misleading. So an index of a politician of like how many Pinocchios they've gotten over the years, it's like, well, yeah, if you're only choosing their lies,
right,
every politician is going to look equally dishonest.
Right.
But like, if you went through the show and you chose every single thing that you said that was like slightly exaggerated and everything that I said that was roughly true, you could say like, oh, well, Peter gets 4 Pinocchios and Mike has 0 Pinocchios. But that you're not looking at the entire corpus of things,
right,
that we've said, right? You're not, unless you're doing it systematically.
And if you did, you would realize that I am the moron.
How dare you? As soon as you talk about speedrunning, 4 Pinocchios, 6 Pinocchios.
4 Pinocchios, speedrunning is actually cool.
So that was a snapshot of some of the hype around the foundation of fact-checking. Over the last 2 decades, as fact-checking has become a more normal part of the news-gathering apparatus, a lot of critiques have popped up of it, and I think some severe structural weaknesses have appeared.
Yeah.
And from the vantage point of 2024, it's looking a lot less like fact-checking is this invaluable mechanism of accountability for politicians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So for the rest of this episode, we are going to talk about some of the structural weaknesses of fact-checking through one of America's least essential fact checkers, Glenn Kessler.
Mm.
I looked at a bunch of Glenn Kessler fact checks over the years. We're going to go into deep Glenn Kessler lore and look at the origins of this kind of stuff. But then you looked into his fact checks of the Democratic National Convention a couple weeks ago.
That's right. We will be fact checking the fact checker.
Ooh, who fact checks the fact checkers? Who snopes the snopes? Yes.
I am anticipating an apology from him to me directly after this episode airs.
So I have a million of these. I maybe have too many.
What's your actual total number of fact checks? I want to know, because I want the people to get a sense of how you operate differently from me, because I have 3.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. A couple of them I cut because they overlap with yours, and then a couple of them are kind of repetitive. I have 12, but I don't think we're gonna do all of them. Well, I'll vibe it out. So we're going to go over these in 3 categories. I will present mine, and then we'll talk about whether or not yours fall into the same kind of category. I think uh-huh. We both looked into this and came up with our own like typology of these, which I think are a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
You can give me as many Pinocchios as you need to for my structure, for my episode structure. So, okay. The first like major problem that you see with it is the selective use of pedantry.
Sure.
With fact checking, there's the question of, are we checking the literal words in the sentence that politicians are saying, or are we checking kind of whether this is meaningfully true?
Right.
So in 2020, Bernie Sanders gives a speech where he says, we will not give tax breaks to billionaires when 500,000 Americans sleep out on the streets. Mm. And so that's the claim. For this episode, I'm going to have me read the claims and you read the Glen.
What if I anticipated what Glenn's going to say right now?
Well, I know you know this because you did the Schellenberger research.
Okay,
what is he about to say?
I believe that he's about to say that just because you are homeless does not mean that you are sleeping out on the streets.
Ding, 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 Peter.
Washington Post, give me Glenn's job. All right. Glenn says, this is a favorite line, but the way Sanders frames it is exaggerated. His number came from a single night survey done by the Department of Housing and Urban Development to count homeless people. For one night in January 2019, the estimate was that 568,000 people are homeless. But the report also says that two-thirds, nearly 360,000, were in emergency shelters or transitional housing programs. The 210,000 others were unsheltered, i.e. on the streets, as Sanders puts it. The number has been trending down over the past decade. It was 650,000 in 2007.
So he's fact-checking the literal words, right? Bernie says people are sleeping on the streets.
Bernie Sanders, drop out. You have humiliated yourself. I'm rating this one monstro, Monstro the Whale.
The thing is, I'm going to say this is like somewhat defensible. I think like if you're going to say that people are sleeping out on the streets, you probably should mean sleeping out on the streets, especially considering that unsheltered homelessness is like a distinct category of homelessness
Sure. That
is measured. And so the point makes just as much sense to say like we shouldn't give tax breaks to billionaires when 210,000 people are sleeping on the streets.
I agree. I think this is like a fine thing to fact check in a vacuum.
Yeah.
However, you need to be aware that what you're really fact checking here is like rhetorical flourish.
Yeah, exactly. And also, you know, if somebody's kind of speaking off the cuff, in your head, you can say, okay, homelessness is 500,000. And in your mind, you can,
okay, what's
a synonym for homeless? Ah, sleeping on the streets. And then it turns out that's technically not true. It's sort of understandable as well. I would say it's like, I mean, if we were doing Pinocchio's, I would do maybe like half a one or one. It's sort of like,
yeah,
I mean, you shouldn't do this kind of thing, but also you sort of get how it happens, right?
It's hard to even call this dishonest. No one is staking out a policy position based on the sleeping on the streets line and then
Right. Finding
out that actually a good chunk of these people are in emergency shelters and being like, oh, well, then what are
Right. You
complaining about? Right. You know, the policy issue is still being framed largely correctly.
Yeah. He's also kind of fucking up the distinction between technically true and meaningfully true.
Uh-huh.
Glenn says, oh, these people are not technically sleeping on the streets because a lot of them are in emergency shelters, but a lot of people in those emergency shelters are regularly sleeping on the streets. They may not have been on the particular night when the point in time count was taken, but if you're saying 500,000 people sleep on the streets, Bernie may not have meant that on a specific night. He may have meant that habitually. Mm. And it turns out on top of the roughly 200,000 unsheltered homeless people, there's around 200,000 temporary beds.
I don't even, you know, the more I think about this, the less I'm even sure that it's
okay.
Like, because like
zero Pinocchios.
Well, I'm leaning towards like 0.25 to zero because
Okay. When
you hear sleeping on the streets, I don't necessarily think of literally sleeping on the streets. To
Right. Me,
that just sounds like this is the amount of homeless people, right?
Right.
If someone was like, oh, there, a lot of them are actually in cars.
Yeah.
Would that change your perception of the statement? No, of course not. That, you know what he means. And I think this is possibly a you-know-what-he-means situation.
I love the car example because then it's like, well, you can do pedantry of like, oh, well, they're not technically sleeping on the streets. But then you can do like uno reverse double pedantry and be like, well, the cars are on the streets. Technically, they are sleeping on the streets.
Like, is your home not built on a street?
Yeah. Like what level of pedantry are we going for here? Yeah.
Right.
So, okay. So that was the example of like, okay, we're pedantically fact checking the literal words in a politician statement. We then rewind to 2011. This is Glenn's first year as the Washington Post fact checker. We have a statement in a speech by President Obama during the recession. He says, Chrysler has repaid every dime and more of what it owes American taxpayers for their support during my presidency. So that's the claim that Obama makes in 2011. This is Glenn's fact check.
Every dime and more sounds like such a bargain. Not only did Chrysler pay back the loan with interest, but the company paid back even more than they owed. Not so fast. The president snuck in the weasel words during my presidency in his statement.
Where's the weasel words?
According to the White House, Obama is counting only the $8.5 billion loan that he made to Chrysler, not the $4 billion that President George W. Bush extended in his last month in office.
So when it was Bernie, we're pedantically checking the words of the statement. For this one, we're saying, well, the words themselves are fine. But the words are bad. Like he included the weasel words.
He's missing context.
Right.
Yeah.
Obama
right.
is doing, I right. think, what fact checkers would recommend that he do. He provides a caveat, mm-hmm. right? Chrysler paid back all the money that we loaned them during my presidency. And he's saying, well, it's only during your presidency,
right.
though.
That's what he said.
Well, yeah. that's kind of the asterisk on this. And this one is so egregious that the actual White House responds. The White House puts out a press release saying, like, first of all, they paid back $3 billion of the $4 billion that George W. Bush loaned them. Mm-hmm. And if Obama hadn't extended them the further $8.5 billion, they would have recouped none of that. The question, again, is like, is this technically true or meaningfully true? It's a much better outcome to extend them more credit and they pay back more of the original loan than to simply lose that $4 billion anyway. So it's sort of like, what actual point are you making here?
Right. So we're seeing both sides of this. One is a sort of demand for pedantry.
Right.
And one is demand for context.
Right.
And it's sort of unclear what you could say about these things that would make Kessler not do a little fact check.
So do you, that's the first category of is selectively weaponized pedantry. Do you have any along these lines, Peter?
I want to step outside of Glenn Kessler for this one because probably the funniest fact check of the DNC was by his colleague Amy Gardner. So Amy Gardner is fact checking Biden's speech on, like, I think it was night one of the DNC. Biden said, quote, Donald Trump says he will refuse to accept the election result if he loses again. Amy says, but that's not true. Trump just hasn't said that he would accept. And she follows up by saying, and he has previously said the only way he loses is if the Democrats cheat.
Right.
Let's piece it all together, Amy.
All of these examples get to the core problem is that the fact checkers think of themselves as doing something like above judgment. Right. They're just applying this like objective lens and they don't want to come to any conclusions. Right. Whereas any intelligent person who's remotely familiar with Donald Trump would say, like, yeah, he doesn't recognize any form of accountability as legitimate, including the last time he fucking lost a presidential election.
Right.
So probabilistically, you know, can you say this as a fact? No. But probabilistically, it's very likely that he will not accept the results of this election. But also that requires you to be doing a little bit of opinionating. Like, that is opinion, right?
Right.
But people who do this fact-checking are not allowed. I think their self-conception prevents them from doing this. So they have to rely on these weird, hair-thin, pedantic corrections of statements like that when you're essentially, you're correcting an opinionated statement.
I mean, I feel like what's happening is that Amy is looking at every line said by Joe Biden and trying to locate a falsehood, right?
Right, right, right.
Because
right.
that's her job. That's what she's out there to do. So from time to time, you're just going to get over your skis because you're searching for it, because you want it to be there. Because not to get too dramatic, but like your career to some degree relies on you being able to locate these misleading statements.
And also what's so interesting about that one specifically is that, you know, Glenn oftentimes defends the practice of fact-checking by saying, look, we don't want to be too pedantic. What we're basically trying to do is inject a little bit of context. We want voters to be informed, and we're kind of using the fact-check as a platform to just inform people about, like, okay, how does, like, the GDP work or whatever. But the Amy example is actually misinforming the public.
Right.
50-50, maybe he'll accept the results of the election and maybe he won't, when, like, that's not really true, right? Like, we know what happened last time. So you end up spreading misinformation under the guise of spreading information and delivering context.
Right, right.
Okay, so the second category of problematic fact checks that Glenn has done is true statements that he designates as false.
Uh-huh.
There are so many examples of this.
This is sort of like, and these are obviously all existing in an overlapping Venn diagram, but that Obama statement is very much like, well, this is true, but
what if I don't like it?
What if it were false?
So my favorite example of this comes from a presidential primary debate in 2019 when Beto O'Rourke, he's talking about like the Green New Deal stuff. He says, wind and solar jobs are the fastest growing jobs in the country. And here is Glenn's fact check. Do your Glenn voice.
What does he sound like?
Do your white guy voice. Do your black comedian doing a white guy voice. That's what I imagine him sounding like.
Okay, well, let me do black comedian. And then I'll transition. All right. The Bureau of Labor Statistics projects solar photovoltaic installers and wind turbine technicians will grow the fastest between 2016 and 2026. But that doesn't mean they are common professions.
That kind of became Brooklyn. I think it's bleeding into your Brooklyn tough guy.
Maybe.
New Jersey tough guy.
Let me take the baritone out of it. The Bureau of Labor Statistics projects solar photovoltaic installers and wind turbine technicians will grow the fastest between 2016 and 2026. But that doesn't mean they are common professions.
Boom. Got him. Got him, Glenn. He said they're the fastest growing professions, but they are the fastest growing professions.
But they're not common.
He didn't say that they were common. He was just straightforwardly correct, but a different claim is not true. So
also he did.
So okay.
What? What the fuck is this? What the fuck is this?
Like, I think what he's trying to get at here is that, like, whenever anything is fastest growing, what that usually means is that it's starting from a very low baseline.
Correct. This is why, to put this in a context that only you and I can understand, when you launch a podcast,
It will
quickly hit the top of the Apple charts.
Yeah.
This causes everyone who launches a medium-sized podcast to believe that they are the number one podcaster in the world for a short period of time. But that's just the algorithm detecting that you went from zero to several thousand people or whatever. What's actually happening is that you are a mid-podcast.
Exactly. That's why everyone keeps saying that podcast is mid whenever we come up due to our placement on the Apple charts. This should have been like a Geppetto. Like, this is the thing where he's like, we rarely give out Geppettos. Mm-hmm. But like, why isn't this just a true statement?
Yeah.
Like, what does a true statement mean in this context?
This is another situation where if the name of the column was like some additional context.
Right.
Then you'd be like, all right, sure. But the fact that you are presenting it as a fact check makes the whole sort of framing a little bit suspect because you're not really fact checking. You're just adding information that you think is useful. That's great, but it's not fact checking.
I probably have too many examples, but there's also there's an infamous one where Bernie Sanders said millions of Americans are forced to work two or three jobs just to survive. And Glenn is like, well, that's true. There's 5.2 million people working two or three jobs, but a lot of those jobs are part-time. Mm. So it's like, okay, well, there are millions of people working two or three jobs? Yes.
Thank you, Glenn.
Dude, I did like a site, like WAPO.com search for Glenn Kessler, Bernie Sanders, and like he fucking hates Bernie Sanders so much.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's so obvious. Like, all of his fact checks of Bernie Sanders are Bernie saying something that's just straightforwardly true. And then Glenn, like paragraph upon paragraph, just like yelling at him and calling him a liar.
You say that the child tax credit has been successful, but the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, Bernie.
So the next claim that he looks at is three people in this country own more wealth than the bottom half of America.
Oh, okay. I got it.
You know this one too, right?
I believe so. I believe that what he's going to say is like, this is only true if you count debt.
Yes.
Bam.
Basically.
Bam.
Yeah.
Washington Post, call me.
Boom.
You can fire your research staff. I can do this off the dome. I will save you millions.
The thing is, I think Glenn is also doing this off the dome, to be fair.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So here's this.
Here we go. Glenn says, this snappy talking point. Fuck you, Glenn, you fucking dick.
Snappy talking point.
This snappy talking point is based on numbers that add up, but it's also a question of comparing apples to oranges. Sanders is drawing on a 2017 report from the left-leaning Institute for Policy Studies, which says that three billionaires, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and Warren Buffett, had a total wealth of $249 billion. Compared to $245 billion for the bottom 160 million of the United States. But people in the bottom half have essentially no wealth, as debts cancel out whatever assets they might have. So the comparison is not especially meaningful.
That's the end of the column, by the way. He doesn't like say like why isn't it meaningful,
yes.
Glenn?
You might think that the bottom 160 million have very little wealth, but that's because they have essentially no wealth.
They have no wealth, and the billionaires do have more than them.
Yeah, this is something that I've heard people say many times where it's like, yeah, but that's only if you count debt. Right. It's like, well, yeah. You should count debt. Right. What are you talking about? What the fuck are you talking about? Why would you ignore debt?
But then, okay, what's interesting about this one, though, is that there's a huge blow up about this. Glenn gets yelled at by like all corners of the internet. And then he issues an update. This is another like specific Glenn pattern, not necessarily a problem in fact checking, but a problem with Glenn that like he does not take criticism well at all. So here is his update to this post.
I am being attacked by communists online. All right. He says, oh, not even that far. There was some Twitter outrage. I love it when pundits frame criticism as like Twitter criticism,
yeah,
just to demean it when it'll be like, no, it was like other journalists on Twitter.
It was other. Yeah, exactly. And like articles in like various political blogs and stuff who were also pointing this out.
There was some Twitter outrage about our conclusion that the comparison was not especially meaningful. So we checked with Emmanuel Saez, the University of California, Berkeley professor who is the pioneer in this field of research and often cited by Sanders. He said he agreed with our assessment.
He agrees with us.
Quote, the real scandal here is that the bottom half of U.S. families own essentially no wealth on net because debts cancel out whatever small assets they may have, he said in an email. If you exclude cars, the wealth of the bottom 50% is actually slightly negative, according to the most recent distributional Fed statistics. You don't even need to be a billionaire to own more than what the bottom half of Americans own. Billionaires in the Forbes 400 owned slightly less than 1% of total wealth back in 1982. Now they own about 3.5% of total wealth.
The statement I want to zoom in on here is he said he agreed with our assessment.
Nothing in there.
I don't think he does.
Here's how he's being sort of slippery. All he did was say, this is only true if you include debt. And then he was like, and therefore it doesn't really matter.
Right.
It's that second part is what everyone is yelling at you about, dude, not the first part. So he's saying, well, this economist agrees that this is only true if you count for debt. It's like, yeah, no, everyone agrees with that, Glenn. It's the conclusion you're drawing from that everyone thinks is fucking stupid.
And also the guy in his email, you know, points out that they used to own 1% of total wealth and now billionaires own 3.5% of total wealth. So we're talking about an overall problem of increasing inequality in the United States, right? And so the basic fact here, which is true, is that if you have $1, if your net worth is $1, you are richer than the bottom 50% of the United States, technically, right? Because if, you know, you go to college and you're $90,000 in student debt, then your net worth is negative $90,000. So anyone who has a dollar has technically more net worth than you. But the idea is that basically you have this asset, essentially, that you paid $90,000 for. Eventually, your earning power will be such that you're much more likely to have a sort of an okay life after that. What Bernie is saying here is, it is true, right? Billionaires have more wealth than the bottom 50% of Americans. And he's essentially doing like a rhetorical flourish, right? He's talking about the top 0.001% and the bottom 50%. He's using that as an illustration of rising inequality in America, which is true. There's a sort of an interesting methodological thing about how they measure net worth.
Right.
But why is that not a meaningful comparison?
It is a meaningful comparison. And like debt is worse than no debt.
Right.
And like, yeah, there are some people who, for example, when you are fresh out of law school, you might be a couple hundred grand in debt, but also making a couple hundred grand.
Right.
That person is not experiencing any financial difficulty.
Right.
And so measuring their financial situation by their wealth is a mistake, right?
Right.
But student debt is also crippling for people who don't have higher incomes in many cases. So like you do want to count their debt in those situations.
And although there's many countries where if you go to medical school or law school or college, you don't end up $90,000 in debt.
Yeah.
The fact that so many people are in so much debt is kind of part of the problem of inequality that Bernie is talking about.
All right. I have one in this category, I think.
Ooh, okay.
There was a statement by Hakeem Jeffries at the DNC. He said, quote, Trump was the mastermind of the GOP tax scam, where 83% of the benefits went to the wealthiest 1% in America. Kessler described this as mostly false, and he says that he has previously given the statement three Pinocchios.
I actually read one of these. Yeah, he did a lot of these, like the same thing when all this debate was going on. Yeah.
When Republicans passed their big tax cut bill in 2017, they put an expiration date on some of the tax cuts for individuals, meaning that over the span of the next decade, people whose taxes were initially cut, their taxes would rise again. That allowed the budget math to make a little bit more sense.
Right.
And it also creates political pressure to extend those tax cuts before they expire, right? Any president who's in office when the taxes are about to go back up again might think, ooh, bad idea. Let's get a bill passed to cut to keep those cuts in place. So Hakeem Jeffries' statement that 83% of the benefits of the bill went to the wealthiest 1% is true, but it assumes that the tax cuts won't be extended, which they might be.
Right.
So Kessler is saying that that makes it mostly false because the tax cuts might still be extended. That's three Pinocchios. What the fuck is what's two Pinocchios then?
He also I found one where he dings Bernie for making this exact same claim. This like 83% go to the wealthy. He's like, Bernie's being misleading because that won't apply until 2027.
So that's the same claim. He's basically saying, well, if in 2027 there has been no extension.
Right.
Then you could look back and say, yeah, 83% went to the top 1%. But it's like, no, dude, they passed a law.
Yeah.
The output of that law was 83% of the benefits going to the top 1%. That's like an uncontested fact here.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
He's like, but what if something changes? You must account for that. No, dude.
No.
It's not a lie. It's not a fucking lie.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't get it. It's not even, this is like beyond pedantry.
Right.
It's not even like adding context. It's literally saying someone might pass a law later that makes this not true. What are you talking about?
Well, you know what it is, Peter? You know what it is? It is our third category, political punditry disguised as fact checking.
Mm-hmm.
I have, you are absolutely going to love this one, Peter. I have a fact check from 2012, from the 2012 election, where he's fact checking the voiceover of an Obama attack ad on Mitt Romney. So the voiceover of this ad says, running for governor, Mitt Romney campaigned as
No, do the voice.
I'm not doing the voice. I can do long pauses.
All right, then do black comedian.
It says, well, it's a voiceover, so it's probably like terrible voiceover voice. Mm-hmm. It says, running for governor, Mitt Romney campaigned as a job creator, but as a corporate raider, he shipped jobs to China and Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
That was from the Obama campaign ad. And then here is the first part of Glenn's fact check.
Oh, hell yeah. I was wondering if he was going to be pedantic about the shipping jobs or the phrase, and phenomenal to see that it's about the phrase.
Yeah.
He says, the phrase corporate raider has a particular meaning in the world of finance. Here's the definition on Investopedia. For context, for folks who don't know, Investopedia is where first-year lawyers go when their corporate clients are involved in some shenanigans that you don't understand.
Oh, yeah.
And you're like, oh, fuck, what is this? What type of security is this? How does this work? You go to Investopedia, and then you go talk to the partner, and the partner's like, what is this? And you're like, don't worry, sir, I looked on Investopedia.
That's the first sentence of your essay. Investopedia defines short selling as.
A corporate raider is an investor who buys a large number of shares in a corporation whose assets appear to be undervalued. The large share purchase would give the corporate raider significant voting rights, which could then be used to push changes in the company's leadership and management. This would increase share value and thus generate a massive return for the raider.
So that's the Investopedia definition of corporate raider. So here's the rest of Glenn's fact check.
In other words, this is generally an adversarial stance in which an investor sees an undervalued asset and forces management to spin off assets, take the company private, or break it up. In a previous life, the fact checker covered renowned corporate raiders such as Carl Icahn and his ilk. We have also closely studied Bain Capital and can find no examples that come close to this situation. Its deals were done in close association with management.
With management.
Indeed, Bain generally held onto its investments for 4 or 5 years in contrast to the quick bust-em-ups of real corporate raiders. So calling Romney a corporate raider is a real stretch.
They did ship jobs overseas, but management wanted to ship those jobs. So can you say it's bad?
I love using the technical definition of corporate raider, which like it's not like the SEC has a definition of this that I know of. You know what I mean?
It's just a pejorative term for private equity.
Yeah.
It's basically,
exactly.
It's like, yeah, fuck these guys. You buy a company, you make it more quote unquote efficient, which oftentimes means laying people off, shipping jobs overseas, whatever. And then you sell it back for a big profit. You're basically flipping it the way that you would flip a house.
Right.
This is an opinion. It's like, I was thinking of, you know, if someone called us, like Mike and Peter, like dirtbag leftists, you can't like fact check that. That's like, that's a pejorative way of saying we're like a progressive podcast.
Or like maybe 7 years ago, someone put together a definition of dirtbag leftist that like technically wouldn't encompass us.
Right.
And then we were like, actually, the definition of dirtbag leftist is this.
It's basically what they're saying is like, this is a left leaning podcast and these guys suck.
I would say three Pinocchios. Michael Hobbs is center right.
So this gets four Pinocchios, by the way. This voiceover.
What?
He does
what?
Also go into this thing of like shipping jobs overseas. He's like, yes, Bain does that, but Mitt Romney wasn't overseeing it when Bain was doing that. And like shipped jobs to cheaper states. Like they shipped it to Tennessee where there's like less union representation, but not necessarily overseas. But also there's like an Indian call center that a Massachusetts company was going to outsource to, and Mitt Romney vetoed a bill that was going to prevent that. It's like another one of these ones where it's like just kind of true, but he's sort of making it more technical and somehow gives it the highest rating. This is a whopper.
Whopper, Glenn, is like, where were you last night with friends? That's a whopper.
Exactly. Or like 80% of what Trump said.
Right. I rate this one Figaro. Geppetto's little cat.
But he's just doing political punditry here. Like, this is an op-ed column, right? He's like, is it fair to call Mitt Romney a corporate raider? No, I think private equity is an important part of the economy, blah, blah, blah.
Context, America is the greatest country in the world. Let's get that straight.
So the third entry in this category, and this is going to be a much longer story, is, I hate talking about this because it's really ugly, but we have to talk about the Ohio rape victim story.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I'm just going to walk through this chronologically. This happens in the summer of 2022. So on June 24th, the court overturns Roe versus Wade. Within hours, Ohio passes a law that bans all abortions after 6 weeks. This is one of those like heartbeat bills. I'm going to send you a description of the law from the Indy Star. I should also say, like, trigger warning for all of the stuff that you would expect in a story about like rape and abortion and stuff.
Abortions beyond this threshold are legal if the provider determines it's a medical emergency and necessary to prevent the pregnant person's death or serious risk of the substantial and irreversible impairment of a major bodily function. There are no exceptions for cases of rape and incest or fatal fetal anomalies. What constitutes a medical emergency is not clear and left to the physician's reasonable medical judgment. Doctors who provide an illegal abortion face a fifth-degree felony. The state medical board can also pursue disciplinary action against doctors who don't maintain the required medical records for abortion procedures. The board can fine them up to $20,000 for each violation.
So this is like really draconian.
Yeah.
Like it's nuts.
A lot of these laws intentionally create a gray area that at a glance looks like a good thing. Like,
right.
Oh, there are exceptions for these vague, dangerous situations. But
right.
How that actually functions is that it creates a situation where, because it's gray, if a doctor decides to perform an abortion in that gray area, they are risking prison.
Right. And it's sort of like, well, we're not monsters. Like, obviously, in the case
right.
of an emergency, you can perform an abortion. But because it's not defined, that's kind of a judgment call, right? Does this threaten the life of the mother? Or is this just something that will have medical complications that will be severe? And you're basically putting doctors in a position where they would have to go to court and defend this decision after the fact. So it's a huge disincentive.
Yes, there have been court fights about this. The biggest one was in Idaho, which made
right.
its way up to the Supreme Court, where like there's a question of what exactly impairment of a bodily function means. And
right.
yeah, again, that gray area results in the state being able to prosecute doctors.
So 3 days after this Ohio law passes, a OBGYN named Caitlin Bernard in Indianapolis gets a call from a child abuse doctor in Ohio who says, I am in my office here with a 10-year-old girl who is 6 weeks and 3 days pregnant.
Mm.
He essentially says, like, we need to get this person an abortion as quickly as possible. And so Caitlin Bernard works with this doctor. 3 days later, this 10-year-old, I believe by her mother, is driven to Indianapolis. It's about 3 hours away. And she gets an abortion on June 30th. So this all happens. No, of course, the country doesn't know about this. On July 1st, 2022, we get the first news report about this. So the Indianapolis Star publishes a story called Patients Head to Indiana for Abortion Services as Other States Restrict Care. And it's essentially like a feature story where they call up a bunch of OBGYNs in Indiana and they report that like, yeah, we're getting a huge influx of patients from Ohio and Kentucky, which also had a trigger law. Mm-hmm. The article starts with this story by Caitlin Bernard saying, I had this case of this 10-year-old.
Uh-huh.
So this story comes out. It's a sort of a random local story, but of course it blows up because like this anecdote is so fucking horrifying. So this is kind of bouncing all over the place around the internet. Everybody's horrified. Eventually, Joe Biden is giving a speech where he's signing an executive order protecting abortion rights. And he cites this story. And he says, this isn't some imagined horror. It's already happening. 10 years old, raped, 6 weeks pregnant, already traumatized, and then forced to travel to another state. And then after this happens, so the following day, Glenn Kessler publishes a fact check of this anecdote. So the article is headlined, a one-source story about a 10-year-old and an abortion goes viral.
Oof.
He says, the only source cited for the anecdote was Bernard. She's on the record. But there's no indication that the newspaper made other attempts to confirm her account. He reaches out to the Indy Star. They don't get back to him. He reaches out to Bernard. He says, Bernard declined to identify to the fact checker her colleague, this is the child abuse doctor in Ohio, or the city where the child was located. He then says, as a spot check, we contacted child services agencies in some of Ohio's most populous cities, including Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati, Dayton, and Toledo. None of the officials we reached were aware of such a case in their areas. So he's basically saying, this is a little bit fishy, right? We only have this one source. I'm going to send you this. This is the final three paragraphs of his story.
This is a very difficult story to check. Bernard is on the record, but obtaining documents or other confirmation is all but impossible without details that would identify the locality where the rape occurred. With news reports around the globe and now a presidential imprimatur, however, the story has acquired the status of a fact, no matter its provenance. If a rapist is ever charged, the fact finally would have more solid grounding. I don't even understand he's like playing journalist here.
No, oh, completely. Yeah.
Is this the only fucking story in the country? There's just one source. And by the way, like not the worst source, right? Like they're on their record. They're putting their neck out there. This is like their profession. The implication here is like, well, maybe this doctor's just lying.
Yes. And what's amazing about the story is he doesn't say this, but he implies that it's a little bit fishy. That Bernard won't provide any more information about this. And like one reason why she wouldn't provide any more information is because she's lying and she made it up. Another reason she's not providing any more information is because it's literally illegal for her to provide information on a fucking patient.
Well, the HIPAA regulations have a carve out for fact checkers. This reminds me of a certain type of fact checking error, which is that often they actually don't know enough.
Yeah.
To do the fact checking, but they think they do.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So they end up over their skis like this. Now, this is a little different because the fundamental issue is that it feels fucking insane to publish this.
I know.
Like, it's one thing to go trying to verify and sort of hit a dead end.
Right.
It's another to hit that dead end and then publish this fact check as if maybe it's all made up.
Yeah.
Then you're sort of taking a position.
And also another thing he doesn't really mention in the fact check is because this Ohio law is so deranged, it's going to increase the number of people under 15 who get abortions.
Right.
And Glenn even mentions in his fact check that in Ohio alone, 52 girls under age 15 get abortions every year. So this is not like a theoretical issue. And all of those kids will have to carry the baby to term, or their doctors will have to do this procedure at extremely high personal risk.
Mm-hmm.
That's the context for the story, regardless of what happens with this specific anecdote.
This is something that like right-wing media does very tactically, but often there is a trend or a law that is bad. For example, mm-hmm. police violence, right? Rather than addressing police violence at scale, you pick apart every interaction that comes to the media's attention, cast as much doubt as possible, et cetera.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's what's happening here, right? Joe Biden isn't bringing this up because this one case is, in his view, worthy of national attention, although maybe you can make an argument for it, but because it's evocative of a problem. He's saying this is the natural result of Roe v. Wade being overturned and these draconian laws, and we need to do something about it because this will keep happening. And it's like, this is what that looks like. That's the point of the story.
Exactly. Yes. The conservative media had already been sort of nibbling at the edges of the story.
But yeah.
Glenn's fact check really ramps this up. So the minute this is published, Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, mm-hmm. tweets it with, "It looks like the story was fake to begin with." We get a Fox News story about the fact that Washington Post published a fact check.
Well, hold on. Let's back up and just make it clear that Kristi Noem shoots dogs, and then we'll continue.
So the entire conservative media ecosystem grasps onto this. Some asshole named Steve Krakauer, who's like a right-wing Substack dude, basically, calls this story this year's Jussie Smollett.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
There's a fucking Wall Street Journal editorial by the editorial board, not just like a random op-ed, called "An Abortion Story Too Good to Confirm." Mm. The Ohio Attorney General starts doing TV appearances where he essentially implies that this has already been debunked. He says, "Every day that goes by, the more likely that this is a fabrication." So we get 4 days between July 9th and July 13th of just wild speculation, everybody basically treating this as if it's been debunked. And then on July 13th, we get an update to Glenn's column. So here is the text that now appears on the story in italics.
Update, July 13th. The Columbus Dispatch reported that a 27-year-old man has been charged with impregnating a 10-year-old Ohio girl who had traveled to Indianapolis for an abortion on June 30th. Gershon Fuentes was arrested after police say he confessed to raping the child on at least two occasions. A police detective testified that Columbus police were made aware of the girl's pregnancy through a referral by her mother to Franklin County Children's Services on June 22nd. While reporting the story, the fact checker had contacted the Franklin County agency to ask if such a referral had been made. A Franklin County spokeswoman said the Children's Services agency was prohibited from sharing information regarding specific cases.
So in his original column, he implied, "Oh, I've reached out to the agencies in all these big cities, and they all say they've never seen a case like this." But it turns out in Columbus, the agency did get back to him and said, "We can't share information. We can't confirm or deny this."
Jesus Christ.
And it turns out there was this case around Columbus, Ohio.
In a real fucking profession, this gets you fired.
Yeah.
This
oh,
gets
yeah,
you
completely.
Fired.
Yeah.
Right.
The thing that makes it so much fucking worse is his total refusal to take responsibility. So
yeah.
This is the final paragraph of his update. So he provides all this information. We've now arrested somebody.
Oh.
Essentially, the story was true. We now know the story is true.
He says, "This is an interesting example of the limitations that journalists face in corroborating this type of story without evidence confirmed by law enforcement. Should Bernard have disclosed the case before the police charged a suspect?
What?
Should the Indy Star have published her account without a second source? Should other news organizations have repeated the story without doing their own reporting? Those are questions beyond the purview of the fact checker, but worthwhile for readers and media pundits to consider."
Many questions.
Now,
many questions.
I don't like how he capitalizes "fact checker" when referring to...
I know, it's so annoying. It's you!
You're yeah. not a creature from myth. You're
yeah.
Glenn. Well, what was the original phrasing? Did he imply that they were unable to say anything?
His original phrasing was, "We contacted child services agencies in Cleveland, Columbus, Dayton, and Toledo. None of the officials we reached were aware of such a case in their areas."
That is essentially a lie, right?
Yeah.
They were unable to confirm whether they were aware or not, and they
yeah.
told him that.
Yes.
He then wrote in the Washington Post that they were not aware. So,
right.
No, you lied in the newspaper.
Yeah.
This isn't an interesting story about like the limitations of journalism or whatever. Like, what did we learn?
Yeah, I know.
What are you fucking talking about, dude? Resign. Resign, bitch.
All of his little rhetorical questions here are trying to spread the fault around. Right?
Yeah.
Should Bernard have disclosed the case before the police charge a suspect? Yes. She's saying, because of this law, I'm now getting 10-year-olds coming to me for abortions. This didn't used to happen. He also says, should the Indy Star have published her account without a second source? We don't know that. The journalists for the Indy Star never got back to Glenn. I think they probably didn't write back to him because it was obvious that he was acting in bad faith. I would not write this guy back either. So we don't actually know that. And also, should newspapers not publish anecdotes from doctors who put their name on it.
Imagine being at the Indy Star and he's like,
oh, yeah.
You get an email. It's like, hello, it's the fact checker here.
Right.
You get a fucking email from a man untouched by the light of God, and you're going to respond to him and give him the name of your other source. Absolutely no fucking way.
And then his third little rhetorical question here is, should other news organizations have repeated the story without doing their own reporting? Whatever you think about that, this is just a thing that happens. People aggregate other things. Like Rolling Stone will say, like, local newspaper says a 10-year-old had to get an abortion in Indiana.
Yeah.
That's just a thing that happens. It's not... But, like, he's trying to say, like, oh, well, the moral fault. Doesn't the moral fault lie with all of us? And it's like, Glenn, it's literally just you in this case.
Yeah.
Everyone else acted fine.
The only thing that we definitively know is that Glenn Kessler should not have lied in the Washington Post.
So the thing that's really amazing about this story, because, like, of course, this was, like, 2 years ago, and no one has really circled back to it. You know, I mean, these things blow up and then they kind of fade away.
Yeah.
It appears this case is like, this is a undocumented Guatemalan immigrant. Mm-hmm. From what we know, according to this report from Telemundo, he was the stepfather of the victim.
Ugh.
The right wing totally pivots, never takes any credit. Mm-hmm. And they immediately go, well, you probably know where they're going with this. This is from PJ Media, one of the outlets that really flogged this at the time.
Uh-huh.
So the alleged rapist, an illegal alien from Guatemala, has been working illegally at a restaurant in Columbus for a number of years. Which restaurant? How many other illegal aliens are they harboring? Blah, blah, blah,
dude,
blah, blah.
They turn it into a culture war thing about this restaurant. The pivots are so incredible.
Fuck
shameless.
Off. And then the Ohio AG, who again is like, well, I've looked around. I've never heard of this case, right? Complete, just using his authority as a law enforcement person to basically imply that this was fake.
Mm-hmm.
After this guy's arrested, he releases a one sentence statement. He says, I am grateful for the diligent work of the Columbus Police Department in securing a confession and getting a rapist off the street.
Mm-hmm.
That's all he said.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
The New York Post quietly changes the headline of the story they published. It originally said, activist tale of 10-year-old rape victim's abortion looks like a lie. That now says, the 10-year-old rape victim's abortion leaves a number of glaring questions.
Does it? Does it? As someone who gets fired from a job now and then, it's so upsetting to me that these people don't get fucking fired.
Do you want to read his defense? He then, after there's kind of more, you know, Twitter outrage, as he calls it, like releases a tweet like defending himself. This is like the last little chapter of the story. This is the last time he's weighed in on it. So here's this.
The last line of this fact check was, quote, if a rapist is ever charged, the fact finally would have more solid grounding. Now a rapist has been charged and the story has been updated, getting lots of angry emails. But journalism is an accumulation of facts.
Just stating the facts. Just doing facts over here.
Other than when you lied about what your communications with the local government consisted of. Sure, sure.
It's also such chicken shit to say, like, well, if somebody ever gets charged, we'll know that it's true. But a lot of rapes, no one ever gets fucking charged. That's not the only way of confirming that a rape happened.
Also, sorry, but like a charge doesn't mean it happened either. Like,
exactly.
Your job is to look at politicians' speeches and pick apart the things they say. You're not a journalist. You don't know how to fucking do this anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm sure that there was a time when this was what he was doing and maybe he was even good at it. But the time has passed. Move on, dude. You're the fact-checking boy.
The thing is, I think the mistake that he made, again, it's the punditry thing that he just wants to be a political pundit.
Mm-hmm.
And he the only platform that he has is as a fact-checker. And so he's trying to do it under this, like, objective standard. This is not a story that you can subject to fact-checking in this way. There just wasn't enough information available.
Yeah.
You can talk about what we do and don't know, but most of the sort of aggregation of this anecdote was already doing that. When you read about it in the New York Times or Rolling Stone or wherever, people were saying, like, according to a doctor, this story happened. We don't have the name. We don't have the name of the child abuse doctor in Ohio. Grain of salt. But what we do have is a named doctor saying that this case happened. Like, everyone's pretty transparent about it.
The story contains the caveat.
Yeah.
If the caveat is just, well, there's only one source for this. Right. They didn't say there were more.
So, okay, so that was Glenn's punditry. What is your last example?
Probably the most egregious fact-checking error of the summer, which night one of the DNC brought us. Hillary Clinton spoke, and in her speech, she said that Kamala Harris, quote, won't be sending love letters to dictators.
Oh, yeah, I love this one. This is a category that I didn't cover where he's just wrong. He's just factually wrong.
This is a reference, of course, to Trump's correspondence with Kim Jong-un, who wrote letters to Trump that Trump himself described as love letters. But Kessler says that Hillary's comment implies that Trump sent letters to Kim. Kessler says, quote, there is no evidence that Trump sent such letters, end quote. We do not know what Trump wrote to Kim. Now, this is notable for two reasons. First, at best, this is wildly pedantic, right?
Yeah.
She's implying that Trump sent love letters to Kim Jong-un, but actually Kim Jong-un sent love letters to Trump. That's the best version of this fact check.
Yeah.
Anyway, more important than the pedantry, there is evidence that Trump sent such letters to Kim Jong-un. And we do know what they said because several were published by Bob Woodward in his book about the Trump presidency.
Oh, right.
Bob Woodward works for the Washington Post. So Glenn could have gone down the hall perhaps found out that these letters do exist. They are published. They included lines such as, quote, being with you today was truly amazing. Trump included newspaper cutouts that included pictures of them together.
Nice.
And said that they were, quote, great memories for me and capture the unique friendship that you and I have developed.
It's so cringe.
Michael, if a man sent you letters that said that, where are you mentally? So Glenn gets called out, of course. He is dragged across social media for this because not only is the fact check dumb and pedantic, it is objectively wrong.
Yeah,
it is
false.
Considerably more incorrect than the fact that he is checking.
Yeah.
So the Washington Post issues a correction, but they do not delete the fact check itself.
Oh, really?
Instead, they keep Hillary's quote in as a fact check, which again, saying that Kamala won't be sending love letters to dictators. And they add this line. The fact check is, quote, this is in the eye of the beholder.
What?
If you're Kessler, your entire mission is to be this like no-nonsense, cutting through the bullshit truth teller, a guiding light in our political storm. But then someone calls you out on getting things objectively wrong. And immediately you're like, what is truth?
It's also very funny to look at this in context of the other fact checks that we've looked at, where it's like, oh, Obama said something true, but he used weasel words. Well, Glenn, you said something false and you're using weasel words.
Right, right.
Like your whole job is allegedly holding politicians to this unreachable integrity standard. And you can't even meet the most basic standard of just like admitting that you fucked something up when you were doing it on the fly.
Yeah.
That's fairly, I think most of us would find that understandable. It's like, I don't know, relatively obscure book. Not all of us have that sort of to hand. But why can't you just say like, hey, we got this one wrong. Like Hillary gets a Geppetto or whatever.
I think it should be more than that. They should give her one free lie that they don't check. Say whatever you want, Hillary.
We'll give you a Geppetto no matter what. Do it.
We will defend you.
Okay, I have general fact-checking thoughts.
Yeah, I do too.
Like maybe this is a weird thing to conclude after this entire episode, but like I think fact-checking is good. I think there's been this kind of baby bathwater problem where a lot of people have kind of turned against fact-checking and are implying that like the whole endeavor is worthless. And I think to me, it always feels like, you know, Armand White writes terrible movie reviews. And so the endeavor of movie reviewing is bullshit.
Yeah.
It is very important for Americans to have like facts in front of them. I also think this thing of like kind of going through with a fine-tooth comb, you know, the State of the Union or the debates and saying like, yeah, this is roughly true, this is roughly false, let's add more context. I think this is really important, right? And I think this is something that politicians should be judged on. One thing that Glenn and other fact-checking outlets do is they have like a promise meter where they look at every single campaign promise that candidates made and like, where are we? Like, is it progressing? Is it stalled? Is it toast? I think that's really useful in a democracy. So like the fact that Glenn sucks at fact checking, I don't think that invalidates the whole endeavor.
Don't let the fact that there has never been a good fact checker dissuade anyone.
The thing is, I'll say there's the bad fact checks go viral on the left, right?
Yeah.
Whereas the good fact checks don't. I don't think very many of us are reading like the Donald Trump fact checks because it's kind of obvious. But like, I think it's important to get this stuff on the record. Like, yeah, he's lying about this. He's lying about that.
There's definitely a someone has to do it sort of vibe, especially when it comes to chronicling the Trump shit.
Exactly. And also chronicling, I think some accountability mechanism of like left-wing politicians as well. Like you know, the thing about like the wealth of the bottom half, like some of these things are fucking stupid, but there are claims that like progressive politicians make, which are not true. And I think it's good to fact check those things. Like the one of his other fact checks in that same column where he dinged Bernie was like there was an AOC speech where she was saying like during the recession, you know, the only reason why unemployment looks low now is because people are taking two or three jobs just to survive.
Yeah.
And he's like, that's not true. Like people, the problem during the recession was that people couldn't get one job. It wasn't that they were doing two or three jobs to survive. And like, yeah, that's a piece of misinformation. I don't think she's like a terrible person or whatever, but like, yeah, politicians get over their skis. It's important to get that stuff on the record. Like, yeah, no, that's not true. Misinformation doesn't go around on the left the way it does on the right. But things like the sort of vacancy trutherism, where people are like, there's millions of empty apartments in big cities, which just isn't true. A lot of people believe it, but it's not true. I think it's important to like call that stuff out. So I think like fact checking as an endeavor is really important. I think what's weird about it is how people who do it and people who don't do it seem to think it's like a totally separate project from the rest of journalism.
Mm-hmm.
When like this should be what like the morning after debate roundup should be, is like it should include they lied. It shouldn't, like, mostly when you read these fucking debate roundups, it's like, Trump seemed strong, but Biden seemed weak. And, like, in Ohio, this might be working in this way. Or, like, Trump is trying to appeal to soccer moms in the Midwest or whatever. It's this fucking horse race bullshit.
Yeah.
When, like, the fact that Trump lied a ton should be part of how we assess his performance as a candidate.
Yeah, I think there's sort of a, it's interesting that fact-checking sort of sprung up as a counterweight to horse race coverage because it does feel like a Band-Aid on a much larger problem, right? And that's, I think, part of the problem with its current form.
Yeah.
Because I think that, you know, fact-checking as an endeavor is certainly good. We should be at least theoretically holding politicians to some standards for honesty.
Yeah.
I think, like, the prevailing wisdom is that the political media wants to both present itself as unbiased and also present political races as interesting.
Yeah.
And that creates a bunch of perverse incentives, right? A lot of journalists have decided that the best way to appear unbiased is to criticize both parties equally, or at least spend as much time criticizing one as the other, which in the micro results in these weird fact checks because like they're reaching to identify misleading statements made by Democrats, for example. And then in the macro, it creates an illusion of a country where both parties are equally dishonest.
Yeah. My conclusion after reading large chunks of this book, Deciding What's True, is that it's actually like significantly more bleak than that. Because what's so interesting about the work of fact-checking is how it began as a critique of both sides' horse race journalism and has become a form of both sides' horse race journalism, right? So Glenn Kessler has numerous quotes in this book where he talks about like, I have to balance things out. I can't only focus on Republicans. I can't only focus on Democrats because I start getting angry emails if they see too many kind of Republican fact checks in a row. And so I have to maintain some kind of balance. But that's the thing you invented this endeavor to prevent, right? If you're doing an equal number, then that's ideological. You set out to like at the end of the week, I have to do five of Democrats and five of Republicans. That's a form of misinformation that's going to make people think that Democrats and Republicans are lying the same amount. And he even says in the intro to this 2020 book, he says, after more than three decades of covering government, politics, and diplomacy, I've found little difference between the two parties on this basic fact. They will both stretch the truth if they believe it will give them a political advantage.
Okay.
So you're just literally doing both sides.
I mean, that is, I think that is true in a vacuum. It's, again, just not particularly meaningful. Like, who lies more? Who needs to stretch the truth more?
Right.
One of the important, most salient elements of the Republican political operation right now is that they need to lie a lot.
Right.
Because their agenda, the one that they all know that they are pursuing, is very unpopular. This creates a situation where they have to lie more. And that needs to be covered as such.
I want to end with a really interesting quote from this book. What's interesting about this book is that you can't really tell if the author is like on board with fact-checking or like thinks fact-checking is bullshit. And he seems to quote like Glenn Kessler. He spent, it appears, a lot of time with Glenn Kessler. And he quotes him a lot, but he seems to just let Glenn like make an ass of himself constantly throughout this book, which I wonder if that's deliberate or not. But anyway, this is a quote about the institution of fact-checking kind of as the rise of Trump is happening.
Fact-checking organizations resist systemic political critiques, assigning blame to one party, or simply characterizing discourse on the left and right as significantly different, in part because such critiques can erode the professional status that allows them to issue individual factual judgments. They acknowledge this more or less directly. As Glenn Kessler told me, quote, if one were to suddenly make a judgment and say, aha, this side is just totally off their rocker, then it completely undercuts my credibility in terms of being what I try to be, which is a really neutral arbiter.
So I think the real problem here is that the institution of fact-checking depends on the reputation for being nonpartisan and the reputation of only calling balls and strikes.
Right.
And if these fact-checkers were to point out the obvious fact that, like, Republicans engage in much more conspiratorial thinking, they lie more, their policies are less popular, that would erode the credibility of fact-checking as an endeavor, right? All of a sudden, all the fact-checkers would be smeared as partisan actors, which of course has already happened. If you talk about Snopes in front of anybody on the right, they'll fucking melt down, right? It's like funded by Soros, all this bullshit, which is not. I think the problem isn't just with fact-checkers. I think there's an elite consensus that anything that comes to a partisan conclusion is fundamentally illegitimate. And all the elite institutions are both sides. But if you start doing this, everyone is just going to be like, ah, he's just like a partisan. He's like Media Matters or something, right?
If you put a headline that said Donald Trump is a rambling lunatic and also he's almost 80 and applies his own rub-on tan every day, that's a Geppetto. That's a full Geppetto. But you can't say it in the newspaper.